Welcome to the Sustainable Ag Writer Podcast, a podcast bringing you news and views about sustainable agriculture from across the southeastern United States. Every show will feature insightful interviews and deep dives into sustainable agriculture topics with farmers, ranchers, land-grant universities, and local food system advocates. Now, here's your host, Brennan Washington.
Welcome to another edition of the Sustainable Ag Writer. I hope everybody out there is doing well. It's another rainy day as I take just another opening, but I'm not going to complain about this rain. We farmers need it. So I hope everybody's doing well. I am not going to talk too long on this opening segment. We have a really good interview with Felicia Bell about market gardens coming up, and I really want to get to that. So I just have a few things I want to talk about today. One of them is the $1.9 trillion American Recovery Act was passed. And within that bill, there is a section that's aimed specifically at Black farmers, mainly to redress just a lot of economic damage that has been done to Black farmers, or I should say farmers of color, through discrimination by the USDA. This has caused a lot of Black land to be stolen and lost, and it's just been a very tenuous relationship with the USDA, to say the least. But at any rate, that bill passed. And as I figure, you know, the backlash to this component of the American Recovery Act has been swift, with a lot of white farmers saying, why are Black farmers getting that money? And, you know, it's not fair. It's reparations, which is really not reparations. But it's interesting that the same people complaining about this funding going to Black farmers were nowhere to be found when Black farmers were just being raked over the coals by the USDA. And I'm talking about for generations, not even just a year or two, but just for generations. So it'd be interesting to see how this all pans out. I'm very interested in the financial help that's going to be given to farmers who are dealing with the USDA. You know, I hope that all of that comes to fruition and that a lot of those farmers' financial burdens can be lessened. But I'm also very interested in some of the other components of the act, including some increased funding for putting up processing facilities and processing plants and infrastructure around farms, especially around local food system. So this is a new act. Everybody's trying to figure out what's going to happen. But I mean, the thing was just passed last week. Nobody knows who's going to be running it. I put some feelers out, and what I was told is nobody knows as of now who's going to be heading up these various efforts. So just wait and see and keep an eye out and keep a nose to the grindstone and keep our ear to the ground, and we'll find out more about it. This is also market season, so I wanted to, Gwen and I have been slowly getting stuff together for our farm, and this is always a nice time of year. Farmers have pretty much gotten their seed catalogs, they're pretty much decided what they're going to be growing this year, and they're looking at their markets. But 2021 introduces us into a much more different landscape than we saw in 2020, even though 2020 was extremely, extremely different for a lot of farmers, and certainly much more different than what we saw in 2019. And I think what we're going to see is this sort of maturing, especially with certain elements of the food system, such as local food systems. I think we're going to start to see some maturing of some of the things and some solidifying of some of the things that we saw take place in 2020. And that's the continuation and strengthening of online marketing efforts, even as we make the pivot back toward in-person farming. I really think online sales are here to stay, and I'm sort of glad it is, because many ways it can be as efficient or much more efficient than going and setting up at a farmer's market. And I'm hoping to see during this season if the interest that we saw with local food during 2020 continues on, that people still continue to support CSAs, still continue to support their local farmers markets, and still continue to support the whole concept of local food. And hopefully this just wasn't a flash in the pan, And now that we're sort of getting back to normal, that everybody goes back to what the original model was. I think there's some real chances for us to make a change here. But that's the question that needs to be answered. So we're going to see what happens. So we're going to be talking about market gardens today. A lot of people, even if you're not a market gardener, meaning that you're not growing food to sell, to actually sell and gain some income from, some of the things that Ms. Felicia is going to talk about can be helpful to any gardener. And so I wanted to have her on just to talk about just market gardens in general, how you, you know, give some basic tips on how you get started, some of the things that you should be looking at, and just give us a nice table to set for some upcoming shows. Next week, we're going to be doing a show on fruit trees and establishing orchards on your farms. So look for that next Wednesday. And let me just start, say, you know, last week's show with Justin Duncan was really a challenge. My internet kept cutting out. Finally got that problem resolved. They had to come out and there was some cable that was messed up. And so I didn't get a chance to talk with Justin about everything that I wanted to talk about. And I also, those folks out there who have known me for quite some time know that quite a few years ago, I was diagnosed with a condition called sarcoidosis. And at the time, I mean, I had to undergo a very, very heavy regimen of steroids. I think I was on steroids for almost a year. My head swelled up to the size of a pumpkin, put on all this weight, so much weight that when I actually started to get back to my normal weight, people said, oh, man, are you sick? You're getting so skinny. But it's during this time of year when we get this wet, damp weather in the spring that my lungs started acting up. And I really didn't notice it. My wife was saying, hey, Brennan, you're wheezing. But I really didn't notice it until I listened, was editing the show for last week. So I apologize if that got on people's nerves. But this is farming and you have to take the good with the bad. So without further ado, let me bring on Ms. Felicia Bell, RDNS Farms and the National Center for Appropriate Technology. Welcome back to the Sustainable Ag Writer. Today, my guest is Ms. Felicia Bell. Ms. Felicia does a bunch of things, which she'll tell you about in a minute. But I know she has a farm called RDNS Farm in Mississippi, Branson, right? Is it Branson or Bradford?
Brandon.
Okay. Yeah. Brandon, Mississippi. And she also works for the National Center for Appropriate Technology. Thanks for joining me today, Felicia.
I thank you so much, Mr. Brandon. Thank you for having me.
Well, why don't you tell folks, I got your bio, but I always like when people tell about themselves. So.
Yes, sir. I appreciate it. Well, I'm fourth generation traditional farmer, and I say traditional based upon things that's been handed down over the years, generationally within our family. We're considered a legacy farm because of that. And my sons are fifth generation farmers. And so we've been doing this quite some time. We are chemical free, want to do as natural as possible. And we raise animals and we inherited, of course, the farm land along with fruit trees, nut trees and all different things, some equipment too. So we're very grateful to get that leg up for my grandfather. And we're just truly, truly grateful to be doing farming and able to share and the knowledge shared with people. And yes, I am an ag specialist for the National Center of Appropriate Technology. Excuse me. We're in the Gulf States Regional Office, which is located in Jackson, Mississippi. And we service Mississippi, Louisiana, Alabama, Georgia, and Florida.
Okay, tell people a little bit about what NCAP does.
Yes, sir. So we are sustainable agriculture, sustainable energy. So we have farmers that want to grow in a sustainable manner, as well as their homestead and their farm operation if they choose to do sustainable energy. And so we have those people, specialists, what we call them under our roof, to help people do that across the nation. We are just one office of six offices across the U.S. And so we do technical assistance, outreach, and so forth. And we do that via email, webinars, podcasts, blogs, workshops, any mode of transportation, I need to say, or transmission to get it to people so they can get the information. We're an educational type of nonprofit. We have over 400 publications that people can download free of charge. And so we're here to help people that want to farm in a sustainable manner.
Yeah. And I've been getting your emails. You've been doing quite a few videos, online type conferences and stuff, right?
Yes, sir. So our particular office is known among the six offices as doing the most face-to-face workshops. All of us have, as people know, we have our skill set. And so our office have done really the most workshops face-to-face. And so, of course, during the pandemic, we had to pivot. And in doing so, I went online. And so I created the weekly Wednesday workshops. So have had some awesome speakers. And that has been, I started in March. So it went from March. We're continuing to do it. I got the go ahead green light from my superiors to keep it going as long as we need it.
Okay, and I'll make sure I put a link to NCAT. Does each office have their own website, or you just go to the NCAT website and they can get to
it? Yes, sir. It's just one NCAT website, the main website, and then you could click on us. It's a drop down, and you could click on the various offices and take you to our landing page, basically.
Okay, Felicia. So today I want to have you on because I know this is something you work with farmers. Actually, today the interview with all the ag leadership cohort dropped today, of which you were part of. Congratulations again. But I know you do a lot of work with helping the farmers prep, and I wanted to do a show. Primarily because I really haven't done anything on actual ag yet, but I want to do a show on prepping your market garden for the upcoming season. So the first question I have for you is, what do you consider a market garden to be?
Yes, sir. So I look at a market garden as intensive growing. So really within, and I have to speak to, and I only can speak to my heritage, you know, not to say I don't work with many, many other farmers, but within the African-American community, farming community, we were taught to space everything out, space everything out. We have rows that are wide enough that a tractor can go down through. And so things have changed over the years. I had to learn that. And I'm wanting to help farmers understand that we can grow tighter, and it helps us even with weed suppression. So to me, just the quick definition of market garden is intensive growing. That's the simplest way I define it.
Now, does the size of a piece of property enter into your definition, or you could be a market gardener with 100 by 100 plot, or you could be a market gardener with 5 acres, right?
Yes, sir. Okay. I agree with you. It doesn't matter the size. To me, a market garden is the output. So it's not how much land you have, it's how diverse you are with what you're growing. And if you're doing it truly in a quote unquote market garden style of what's been put out here for us around the world and within our country, that means you're going to be growing intensively, which in turn you're growing, putting more seeds, more transplants in the ground, which in turn you're going to have a larger output.
That's good. So I'm Joe, new farmer. I just brought a piece of property. I want to start entering into the farming profession. And let's say I've got a 1 acre plot or a 200 by 200 foot plot. Where do I begin if I've never done this before? What's the first things I should be doing, and what should I be looking at? All that good stuff.
Yes, sir. So the first thing I usually assist farmers with is research. They have to learn what their land is about. So first and foremost is that soil test. We need to find out what is there, what they have that's good, and then what is possibly may be lacking. And what I mean by that is minerals. Minerals is what we want in our food. That's what some of us around the country, and some people say the whole country, but if you haven't had some form of industrialized agriculture, you may not be depleted of all your nutrients, you know, but I know our land, we can cipher, and that's what people really mean. But I start out with soil testing. Second is the research of your environment. So where is Joe Farmer in America? what can be grown right now, which we're moving into the spring season. So where are you in the country and what are the vegetables that you know can grow in your region? So that's a research, and I don't do that for farmers. If it's a new farmer, they have to learn how to farm and learn how to farm, and it's starting in online and books and whatever they need to do. Because I'm traditional and I don't push this a lot, but I like farmers to really kind of go by the almanac as well. I don't push it because I know people's belief systems are different and so forth when it comes to the farmer's almanac, but it works. It works because it's a traditional methodology of sun and moon cycles. Because sometimes people, and I've seen this over my lifetime, they plant at the wrong time and they wonder why stuff don't come up. And it's like, you planted at the wrong time. That's why. And so, or they just don't, it doesn't, they don't have a full harvest and they be wondering why, but they don't go by the sun and moon cycle. So that's something I do share with people. If they take it up or not, that's fine. And then we move into working that land. And so the next question I'm going to ask the farmer is, how do you want to work this land? Are you going to till it? Are you going to go no-till? Are we doing truly like the market garden with boxes? Like they lay down the boxes and then you come with maybe a landscape fabric. I've seen that done, but I've seen boxes. And then you come with the compost on top and put the landscape fabric in the walkway. So those types of things I'll be throwing, but like I'm throwing out now, I said that to farmers where they can start thinking about, and we don't look for a decision that moment. It's like farming is planning. And so I try to help farmers realize that you have alternatives, and then you go back and meet with your family and you really decide on what you know. It's not off the cusp. You don't decide what you want to do off the cusp. And then the next last really thing is sharing with the farmer the best seed companies to utilize to have what they want for their family. Most people are looking for production that's not going to harm themselves or community people. And so we give the names of seed companies that's conducive for that.
Now, you've mentioned traditional farming a couple of times since we've started. Can you just give our listeners at least your definition of what traditional farming means?
Yes, sir. So way I define it is the natural way of farming, how farming have been done for millennium. So thousands and thousands of years of how various cultures around the world have farmed. They farm with working with nature, not working against nature, not trying to kill nature. Because you got to work within it. You're out there. And so that's what I mean by traditional is it's going to change daily, basically. And you just got to be able to pivot with that because our environment changes all the time. Our soil changes. I'm having wash off now. And it's not because I have bare soil. It's because I'm under a hill in the water. So we have a lot of revamping for our farm just because over the years we have water is just flooding us and taking our topsoil away. So now we got to push it back up the hill. And so those types of things, life happens. That's farming. And then I know most farmers and lay people may get it confused. And I've heard this. People are confusing conventional with traditional. When most people say traditional, they're thinking more so industrialized agriculture when they say traditional, because that's all most farmers have ever seen in their lifetime. Is the industrial agriculture. So they think it's traditional. And they're like, no, that's conventional. Industrial agriculture, and then you have traditional agriculture that some of us just are utilizing what we were taught, handed down, and what's just culturally relevant to grow food and raise animals.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought up traditional-based practices because, you know, it's funny how you've been in farming quite a long time, and it's interesting to see how we go through these different phases of terminology. You know, we always get these buzzwords. So for a while, it was organic. Sustainability has been around quite a while. And I know it's been around a while because all the large conventionally based companies are starting to use sustainable in their language. But now the hot word is regenerative.
Yes.
Generative. And I've read a couple of articles lately that sort of take exception with the fact that regenerative agriculture actually came from indigenous peoples, but they're not being given their due. You know, it's like all of a sudden this is something new discovered by farmers who, oh, we just found this new thing. But you want to talk a little bit about that, how this is really isn't something new. Look at this as some sort of new fad that just has actually been around probably for thousands of years, right?
Yes, sir, it has. And but the one thing about traditional agriculture, you're moving and adapting with nature. I call it biomimicry, because you're trying to mimic nature as close as possible. But, you know, we're not capable of doing that. We're definitely not the creator. So we're not capable of mimicking it 100%, but you're trying to get as close as possible. And so, yes, traditional agriculture have been around for thousands and thousands of years. But over generationally, you have to change with the environment. Okay. So it is still what you're basically doing is holding on to the foundation. Okay. You're holding on to the foundation of how you're supposed to farm, but you have to tweak it and adapt to your generation. So within my family, we never were taught, you know, you have to do it this way. It's the foundation. Like, I'm not going to use chemicals. That's the foundation. But my grandfather never said, well, you have to farm this way and you never change it. He taught me, you're going to scale it up because you're going to learn better and be able to do better. So I bring in sustainable practices and methodologies with my foundation of that I'm not going to use things that's going to harm me, my family, the land, and the community. That's just my core value.
How long has your land been in your family?
So documented is five generations. Five generations of agricultural, I say agriculturalists. This particular land, it's four generations on this land, the land that I work. And so, like I said, started with my grandfather and ended with my sons are here and working the land. And so that's what I consider traditional, and you move and adapt with the environment, the land, and so forth. Now, regenerative agriculture, yes, is buzzwords. The first word that come in my purview was permaculture. I used to push back on that, not the methodology. So don't get me wrong. I don't push back on the methodology. I just push on the notion of someone creating buzzword. And I'm okay with that, because we live in a country that we could create opportunity for ourselves, which I love. And so what people are doing is they take a methodology and they tweak it a little bit and create a word. But then that word now is that methodology is theirs. And so they're able to capitalize on the word. And so that's what permaculture was, because the gentleman wrote a book. You know, it becomes a moneymaker for the person. But one of the things, and that's what most of us push back on, that is still, I don't mind you making money off of it. You know, that's like I said, that's the blessing of being in America. You could create wealth for yourself, but give homage to where the information is coming from. And that's why people are now, because really people didn't push back on permaculture, but now that regenerative ag is here, people are pushing back. They're like, no, that didn't come from you. And so that's where we are now. But what I'm learning and seeing is the industry that created that buzzword is pivoting. They see they're wrong and they're correct.
Yeah, that's interesting. You should mention permaculture. So I had heard about permaculture for quite a while. And after we had our fire in 15, Gwen and I said, well, this is a good chance for us to try and mitigate some issues we'd be having. So we have the slopes, you know, our farm slopes has some significant slopes down to the actual farmland. And we have a lot of rock under our what little topsoil we have on that hill. We have a lot of rock. So you add water to rock and a slope, you get erosion. So that was the biggest thing. But when I looked at the permaculture practices, you know, the first thing I said, well, I don't know if I could make money in a system like this, you know. So I really brought someone in to do a permaculture design to help me with the water handling aspects of it to help me build in some more biodiversity. But I didn't take it as gospel that this is the way my farm needed to be run. We're going to get back to Joe New Farmer. One thing I want you to talk about that you didn't mention is I'm Joe New Farmer and I want to go out and sell products. How should that farmer approach what he should be growing that could make him some money in his local marketplace?
Mm-hmm. Well, the market research. So it, again, is going back to training this new farmer on how to figure out this for themselves. And so market research is done by going to your local farmer's market, if it's one. See, Joe Farmer may create the first farmer market in their area. And so it's finding out what are your community people eating. So that could be at their church, that could be at their civic, anything that, because we are, you know, social beings. And so we're around a lot of people and it's just asking questions. Mm-hmm. As you're surveying, but you're verbally surveying people. And so we could do that on the slide. You know, you're talking to your friends, your coworkers and so forth, and you can figure out what type of things they're eating. And then that's what you plant. Then I like to have a niche. And so grow a couple of things they've never seen before. Grow some things that, you know, that is still conducive to, like, for an example, if they like mustard greens during the fall, then you have the regular mustard greens, but then throw in the red one, the burgundy one. I always forget the name, but that I grow it because I love the color. But you throw in these things. So it's still a mustard green, but then now you're tweaking what varieties you have. And then when you at the farmer's market, you're different. So you're going to bring a clientele to yourself. But first is the market research and choosing to do that. Secondly is asking that farmer if they want to even level up again, and that's creating value-added product. So farmers markets are raw products, harvesting, washing, banding up or bagging, whatever you choose, and then putting that out on your table. But then value added, of course, is breaking it down into some form of fashion to add value. If it's greens and you cut them up so people can easily put them in their freezer, whatever. But you have changed the composition of that raw produce. And so steady going up the ladder of a person to see how much they want to do, how much work they want to do, and then how much financial resources they have to invest.
Right. We were one of the people who we basically had to do our market research on the fly because we didn't have a market here. And it took us a couple of years. I wish we did have one because we would have saved us a bunch in the learning curve. Mm-hmm. But that's so important. And, you know, you get the excitement that people have. And I hope people will listen to this are taking copious note. But the more time you spend planning up front, the more headaches you're going to save yourself. You know,
yes,
in the long
sir.
Run.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
You can't. And I just see just doing this for so long, people have lost a lot of money just because they didn't plan ahead. And it doesn't take a lot to plan. Just take the time to plan so you don't make these life lessons, you know, because farming is going to be hiccups here. You know, things like even the freeze for us in our area we had never ever in my lifetime have been that cold.
Wow.
So that was a learning curve, but I had to figure it out. We did lose some animals, but my thing is they were in the pasture and I had to give them a windbreak. But the blessing is one of my coworkers taught me about windbreaks because he's in a valley in Montana. They have to build windbreaks, but just seeing his windbreak, it made me understand I got to move them to buildings. They got to get around buildings. And because here I was taught we don't build barns and sheds in our pastures. That's just something my grandfather, but we do silvo pasture. So it's the animals get shade as well as that protection from for trees. The trees give protection. But cold as we were, it wasn't going to help them. And I had to have human intervention. But that's the trial and error. And so if you don't plan ahead, but then also be fluid enough to pivot when something come on you like a storm and you have to pivot and you haven't done the research, you just got to pivot and figure it out. But sometimes farmers are too rigid. they stick to one thing and won't change, but they end up losing. And you can't, you have your foundation, you do what you have to do, but you still got to be fluid.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. And, you know, a lot of people don't like to talk about climate change, but, you know, when I moved to Georgia, my zone was a 7A.
Uh-huh.
I'm 7B now.
It's changing.
So, yeah,
it changed for me too. I'm 8. When we were 7A, B, I'm on the cusp of both of them, but now I could do an 8 easy. And so I'm like, what is going on? I'm steady getting more tropical.
Right.
And I'm like, but I'm still in the same spot. But yes, sir, it's changing.
Yeah. So going back to Joe Newfarmer, so he's done his work. He has an idea how much time he wants, what his resources are. And so for the sake we could do the math easy, he's going to do 100 by 100 plot.
Mm-hmm.
Now, so the first thing is he's tested his soil, so he knows what it, we'll talk about amendments in a minute. What would be your recommendations on how they should lay, how Joe Newfarmer should lay his beds out? How should he actually design his land? Because a lot of people don't pay attention to that. So.
Yes. And see, I love the way you do it, Mr. Brennan, in your high tunnel, because you got walking space. Some farmers I have noticed that will only do a 12-inch, 1 foot walking space. And I'm like, some people feet are bigger than and that. So it gets really tight, but they choose because they want to walk foot over foot.
Mm-hmm.
And so they want it to be tight because they want to grow more. But you do, you know, foot and a half, 2 foot walking row. And then your bed, what I have seen is 30-inch bed, and then people are going up to more. So, you know, 30-inch bed is less than 3 feet, but some people do 3 feet wide, 4 feet wide. We usually don't suggest going over 4 feet because you don't want to step in it. You don't want to have to step into the bed and compact the soil. So, you know, I always suggest 4 feet, but, you know, each is his own. Each farmer have to decide that for themselves. One of the things that I have learned is trenching the walkway. I call it trenching because it's deep. So you're not using a trencher. You're really going back old school and using a shovel, but making the walkway deeper versus, and let me tell you why I have to do this, because I don't have even what's behind me. I don't have a BCS. That's my dream tractor.
Mm-hmm.
But some people do have the tools to help them to create their beds high. They're raised without the wood around them. So you're creating a raised bed. So how we did is you're using a shovel and going down the walkway and making the walkway deeper. You're pulling soil out and throwing it up on the bed. So you're making the walkway deeper, which in turn now is raising your bed up.
Okay.
So that's kind of, we don't work the bed, we work the walkway, and then you get the depth of your bed that way.
That's not a bad idea. I never thought of that.
It's work though, Mr. Yeah. It's work.
Oh, I know it is. I know it is. You know, we keep our
labor.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the thing about intensive farming. You know, the smaller and more intensive you get, fortunately or unfortunately, the less you can go with mechanization, you know?
Yes, sir.
The most you can do is a BCS, which is a hand propelled tractor. Mm-hmm. Some people may look at it and think it's a tiller, but it's not a tiller. You could put implements on it and stuff. But the smaller you go, you know, you need more labor. It's going to be a little bit more time consuming. We go, I think, 18 inches on our rows. And I'll tell you why we did that, Ms. Felicia, is because when I had my back surgery, working in tight spaces as you get older just becomes a problem. You just get more tired fast. And I just said, you know, yeah, I'm going to give up something on the production side, but, you know, no sense having this production. I can't get out to the field to pick it because I'm in pain, you know. So 30 to 48 inches. So once you go ahead and build those beds, let's say you have, I guess you're going to look at your soil test and see if you're going to need to add any amendments. Well, let's talk about some of the more regular types of soil deficiencies and how a farmer farming in a sustainable traditional fashion would address those. Let's start with pH.
Yes. So most of the time we are acidic. A lot of times we're usually more acidic than we need to be. And that's what most farmers bring out the line. And so, but you have to do it months. you know, you got to do it much, much earlier, and you got to time it before you put the seeds or transplants in the ground. It has to be able to work in within the soil. And I could be wrong. So I said months, but most farmers know that have to use that. They know that time frame because you have to do it much earlier. You can't put it, you can't put lime out on Monday and then want to put your seed in ground on Tuesday. Mm-hmm. That's what I mean. So you have to add a time frame when you're working with lime. I want to say decrease, but it's not, it's turning it alkaline. You're going that way on the spectrum, on the pH spectrum. And so that's what lime is doing. And a lot of farmers don't know why they use lime. They just know to put it on their land, but it's for pH. If your land is too acidic, you use lime to start bringing it towards the alkaline, not making it totally alkaline, but you're just moving in that direction.
Mm-hmm. And what's the optimal pH to grow, say, most vegetables? I know some vegetables like an acidic.
Are different. Is it? Yeah. And you may have to help me with this, but I thought I remembered it's like 6.5.
Yeah. Between 6.4 and 5 and 7, I think is what it is.
So you're not totally alkaline. I want people to understand that you're not, you don't supposed to be on one end of the pH scale. You want to be neutral, which is at 7, and you just, you know, close as possible, but you don't want to be too alkaline and you cannot be too acidic. You'll have issues with your growth and then those plants not just taking up the nutrients that are in the soil and so forth. And then we're moving to what does the soil need? So you are reading that soil test. Now, one thing, Mr. Brennan, that I do a little bit different than most is I try to get an extensive soil test. And what I mean by that is the micro minerals, those micronutrients, the manganese, zinc. I like to get soil tests like that. Why? Is because that's what make ones of us that do that make us a niche farmer, because the people taste it in the food, because you have those nutrients in there. And so you're making sure you're putting those micronutrients, micro minerals into the soil various ways and so forth with amendments and natural amendments. So I go, it costs more. But you don't have to do it. You don't even have to do it every 3 years. I just got another one and it's probably been 10 plus years. So, because it's like once you know what your soil needs, then you just do your amendments each year. And again, natural amendments that the soil can take in, like, oh, basically like a person drinking a cold glass of water on a hot sunny day, your soil will take it in just like that. Like, oh, thank you. You're giving me something I need. So it's able to break it down. And so it's not this overly adding amendments. It's not that. It's not that it'll sit on top of the soil. It'll break down and go into the soil.
Okay. And I'm glad you mentioned about the difference in soil tests. So usually when people hear soil tests, they'll run to their extension office and get that basic soil test done. And actually I had Justin's going to be next week's show. And we talked about soils. Mm-hmm. Hopefully I can recover the show because I lost my connection like 3 times during the interview. So I'm hoping it's salvageable. But that's the other thing he was talking about, the importance of minerals. And if you get that basic soil test, it just doesn't give you that information.
Mm-hmm. It doesn't. Mm-hmm. And then I know for Mississippi State, we used to have it. We used to could pay more to get that extensive soil test. But I talked to extension agent a few years ago and they totally took it because the farmers weren't utilizing it. They really didn't know they could do that or were told the purpose of it. They saw the cost on there, but no one have really explained to them why would you pay more for an extensive soil test. So they weren't using it, so the lab just took it off.
Yeah, and they probably get mainly commodity farmers coming through there, and they're just looking at nitrogen, phosphorus, and
potassium.
But anyway, they're looking at those three nutrients.
Yeah.
And if you're trying to farm intensively, you need to look at the whole spectrum.
You have to. Yeah.
Okay, so you get your soil test back. What is the easiest, how should you treat? So we did pH, you're going to add your lime. And can you explain what type of lime you should use? Because a lot of people don't know that. I always say it's the difference between using lime that your plants like or using lime like you used to see in the gangster movies. They throw somebody in a hole and they put lime on them so they dissolve. Those are two different types of limes.
Right? It is. Well, the one, and what I was always taught, and I could be wrong, that the one that most of the, even the big commercial farmers are utilizing from the extension, I mean, from the co-op, is supposedly what I was taught, natural. What I've learned and thought is that lime, that way, the white that you see that makes the smoke, people like, what is that, is a natural lime. I just always have thought that over the years that I don't know if they can chemical base that. They may. But yes, sir, we're not talking about a liquid form or anything like this. And most of the time, it is the white powder. And most farmers get it from the co-op. Smaller people can get it bagged and you can apply it yourself, but please, please, please wear a face, nose, not cover, you know, because you're not supposed to let those particles go up your nose, your eyes, mouth. So you have to wear your mask if you're going to apply it as a small producer. Most of the time, the co-op stays in the truck. They drive the truck over your land and they're not out there in it. But yes, sir, that's and like I said, I could be wrong. To be honest with you, I have to learn more because I don't have to use that here. We have always had animals on this land, and that's what have kept our soil up to par is the manure, which I think that's, we're going to continue to talk and get to that.
Yeah. And actually, I was going to move, and it is potassium. That was bugging me, but it is potassium. Okay. And secondary nutrients are calcium, magnesium, sulfur. But I'm glad you brought up animals because the next thing I was going to talk about, fertilizers. And so when we first started keeping chickens, we had them a little bit further up on the property. And we used to, before they got all strict with, you know, the food safety stuff, we used to let our chickens, especially after we pulled down a crop of greens or something like that. We used to let them clean up the litter. You know, we would never go and hand pick all that stuff up. We would just let the chickens go. And so we had all raised beds in that area. And it came a time where we moved. We had to move those raised beds because we were redesigning the farm. And I went out and had a soil test. Do you know in that area, I did not have to put down a single nutrient.
I know.
Everything was right on point. So can you talk a little bit about that? How important, if you can do it, how important it is to bring animals into your nutrient cycle?
And then I always say, when you say, if you could do it, I try to tell farmers, you don't have to become a livestock producer to utilize animals. It's like, do it for yourself. If you have a small ruminant, which is a sheep, goat, and rabbits, people forget about the little rabbit is a ruminant. And so you can raise small animals for your personal homestead meat. So you raise it up. You're using it for the manure, but then when they get, you know, of age and mature, you slaughter to put meat into your freezer. So you don't have to have 10, 15, 20 and above head of animal to utilize the manure for the from animals. But that's all I had ever known. And that goes back to just the traditional methodology of utilizing animals. We have always had animals on this land and continue to have animals. And so we utilize them dropping it. So we don't do the how people are composting by picking up the manure, like putting the manure in compost windrows. We don't do that. We let the animals drop. So we're moving them across the, you know, for us paddocks. We're moving the animals and they're dropping it naturally. That's one task I'm not going to do. I'm not doing that. I have done that when I wanted for my vegetable garden. I'll fence them in on a concrete slab and let them drop. And then I let them go and then we go shovel. But I got a purpose for that manure. But as far as the land itself and keeping it up to par, we let the animals drop. Other thing is we do harvest because we do have smaller animals. So we do the rabbits, we have quails. So we're harvesting their manure and we don't waste anything here. That's another thing that's taught too. You just don't waste anything.
Yeah.
But we use that as the vegetable production fertilizer. When we harvest that and we hold it in various containers, let it compost, and then we can use it for years on end.
So In addition to animal manures, are there any other types of fertilizers you would recommend to Joe New Farmer?
Yes, sir. So it may not be defined as a fertilizer, but a nutrient builder is alfalfa, as well as kelp meal and seawater. That's a big thing people don't realize. You know, most people, they eat things that have sea salt in it. But a lot of people don't realize why are they eating it, because it has a lot of minerals in it. So the same, just the ocean water itself, and we have companies in our country that do that, where you can, it's in liquid form that you can spray on your beds, and it helps. I mean, it really, really helps. And that's really even under, most people may not hear about it, but it's kind of under the biodynamic way of farming, when you utilize the seawater and so forth. But yes, sir, now those types of things, you're putting nutrients into the soil. Right. So I guess you would define it as fertilizer, but you know, it's adding nutrients, and that's all of them are adding nutrients.
And I guess the maybe the terminology we should move towards is nutrient management, because it's more than just fertilizer. Because actually that's something Justin talked about during his interview, is how he uses sea salt in a foliar spray to treat his plants. Another way of getting organic matter and things like nitrogen into your soil is the use of cover crops. So, A, do you use cover crops on your particular farm? And what types do you use, and what do you use them for?
So I sometimes, but really I let the natural things come up. So because most cover crops you're planting. Mm-hmm. And so I'm kind of being asked and pushed into doing that for demonstration purposes. But for as just how I have farmed over the years, I have not just strategically say I'm going to plant a cover crop. Mm-hmm. So right now you go to the farm, it is grown up, but it's natural cover. Okay. And that's really how. And then we usually go and put a silo.
Silage tarp.
Thank you. I was losing the name. A silage tarp or the landscape fabric to let that be the green manure. We let it die under that black plastic, and that's what we create. And then we just take it off, and we're able to directly grow in the ground, because we don't have to do
it. And how soon before the season do you put that down? Either that silage tarp or that plastic?
It's usually, like, I have had mine on for a while because I'm leaving it. So my silage tarp, where I put it, was inside the high tunnel, because I have heavy, heavy growth in the high tunnel. For years, we have had to compete with weeds. Yeah, and stuff. So I was like, I got to take this out. And so I laid mine down last spring, but I'm leaving it there. I'm not going to bring it up. And then, you know, we're leaving it there. But now the difference between you and I, Mr. Brennan, in my high tunnel, I do bucket. I'm not in the ground. I do anywhere outside of my high tunnel.
Okay.
And so I strictly use a high tunnel to do the buckets, and then regulate the temperature with the cloth or the plastic, you know, the shade cloth or the plastic in the high tunnel with the buckets. And that's another thing, just to put this out there for farmers. Every farmer is going to grow differently in the way they do. And the reason why I use buckets, because I'm busy. I'm not here. And so it's like I needed something to be able to grow food, but I didn't have to weed every day because I'm just not here every day to do that. And so that's the reason why I chose that methodology. But the silage tarps are put on usually a month or two. It's a ways. It, like, now it's cold, you got to put it on longer because you don't have enough sun to burn, to heat up. In the spring and summer, you could sometimes put it on 2-3 weeks before you get, because it depends on how hot it is in your region at that time, because all it needs is heat.
So, like, when you keep yours on over during the summer, inside that high tunnel, it's really going to heat up, kill all those weeds and stuff.
So it really, really works. And you can get silage tarps that are small, or you can, like, behind me, it was a silage tarp. That picture is silage tarp was used to cover that as well. So you could get the huge ones to cover large areas, or you could get, I think it's like a maybe a 30 by 30. It's small, like for a garden area that you could get the smaller ones to cover up. But but yes, sir, it's not that long of time if you're already in the spring and summer months.
Yeah, we kept one on. We just had an area. The bane of our existence here is Bermuda grass and nutsedge. Those are, because this was originally conceived as a residential property, you know, we were just a little, you know, with 3 acres on it, close to 3 acres on it. Mm-hmm. So I don't think when they built this house, they were thinking about anybody coming in and doing farming. You know, Bermuda is a pain. It's great if you have livestock, but if you're trying to grow stuff, it's really hard to get rid of. And so we just left it down for like a year and it killed most of it. It killed. We still had some nutsedge.
You had nutsedge left over.
Yeah.
That's hard to kill.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. I've learned about, I'm Joe Newform. I've learned about doing my research. I've learned about how to shape my beds and looking at my nutrients. Now I'm ready to plant. So let's talk about different spacing for different plants. So we use what I call a modified square foot, but tell everybody how you approach spacing your plants.
Yeah. So, oh my goodness. And I'm losing the name. I can't think of it right now. I definitely sent it to you, Mr. Brennan, so you could send it to the audience. But I found a farmer. He teaches about market gardening, and I got it from a former coworker, and he ended up making an instrument, an apparatus tool that spaces it out for you. And so you don't need a tractor. It's not something to put on a machine or anything. It's hand pull, and it just goes through there. But your soil got to be fluffy. We say fluffy because it can make that indentation in your soil. But yes, sir, it is different spacing. And I wish I don't know if I could pull that chart up real quick to look at it, but it is a chart to tell you the spacing for various vegetables. Like it is a spacing, but I can know off the top of my head, a lot of times it is like 10 inches. A lot of times it's close. And you know, it's usually that spacing between that two is you could do 10 inches. I know one is he calls it a 4x4. I think we got is it 8x8, but I can't even remember the name of the company. I'm sorry, I'm forgetting, but I can't even remember the name of the company.
It's not that book that you're using in your leadership project, is it?
No,
you had ordered.
This is a whole different. This is a gentleman, and I apologize. I just cannot think. But we bought the tools, that's what I used to use, and to start to let people know where I started and where I am now. I started with a ruler.
I was out there on my
hand and knees ruling it, and I'm like, it got to be a better way. And I did that for years, but then again. Financially, I had to build myself up. The farm had to build itself up, had to make money. So the farm can buy the tool, not pulling out of you. And that's what you want your farm to be able to do. So, you know, I had to start with the ruler.
And that's what we did. You know, in all our raised beds, we just took some spray paint and marked off 4 intervals. And so we know where square foot was. And for example, we started out with square foot.
The
recommendation. But some of them we changed because I think he said in you can do 12 heads of lettuce in a square foot. We find that was a little too tight, you know.
Okay.
So we go nine so we can get some nice fluffy heads.
Larger heads.
And then some stuff, you know, we're still trying to figure out how to intensively plant it. You know, large crawling vegetables, for example, like squash. We're still trying to figure out how tight can we get them and still be able to maximize our space, you know, and still get a good crop over them.
Yeah.
Do you grow squash?
I do. I do grow squash, and I have done like a foot.
Okay. That's about what we've been doing.
But you're right. It's tweaking it, and that's but that's farming. You got to play with it because again, it goes back to the soil nutrients. Mm-hmm. So the plant is not going to grow big if it don't have the proper nutrient. And so, but if you have the nutrients in that soil, that plant is going to grow vigorously. And then you may be like, well, we may have to go 18 inches next year. See, it's that kind of stuff. So you may not be able to for, you know, for your listeners, you may not, again, be so rigid. That's, I just want my farmers to understand it's fluid. You got to be fluid, because one season could be 12 inches, next could be 18 inches, then you up to 2 feet. It depends, because, but that's good for you, because that means that you have proper soil. You have good organic matter, and your plants are eating it up, sucking it up, and you're getting vibrant plants. They're growing bigger and wider. And so it's not a bad thing that your spacing is getting wider. It's because you're going to have bigger and better fruit in the end.
Now, do you have any vegetables that you use trellises on? We do a lot of trellising here.
I don't. Like and that's just me and a learning curve. I just really didn't learn how to do that well growing up. And so that's just because I don't know how to do it. I don't grow a lot of stuff. I know how to do the line up in the high tunnel for tomatoes. I don't do big tomatoes. I always like cherry tomatoes. And so I love cherry tomatoes. One, while I'm out there working, I can eat them and stuff. Not to say you can't eat the big tomatoes, but the cherry is just easier for me. Mm-hmm. And then consumers look like I'm able to sell cherry tomatoes quicker. And I like the it's like a black beauty, but it's a dark tomato, cherry tomato. Mm-hmm. And so you still that niche. It's a cherry tomato. People like it. But then I change the color on people, and that that brings people to you and stuff. So I know how to tie off tomatoes. I want to learn how to do the trellis with cucumbers, because my cucumbers, usually if I don't, you got to pick it almost like okra and squash. Like every day you got to go out and see if you have a harvest, because they'll get too soggy. But I want to learn how to make cucumbers vertical where I could just walk up and
pick them. We use that. I don't know if you're familiar with Hortonova. It's a plastic white netting. Johnny sells it with different sizes of squares, and we just run that on T-posts 4 foot apart and just train them right up that. And some people do the do like an A-frame for the cucumbers. Yes. We don't do that. We just make sure it goes down the other side of it, which we do naturally. But we've had really good luck with that and with pole beans and stuff like that.
So, good,
my wife hates it, because especially with the cucumbers, she has to train them and stuff like that, and the pole beans. But I don't mind going out there and picking them and retraining them. But I'm glad you mentioned cherry tomatoes. For Joe Newfarmer, can you explain to folks exactly how big cherry tomato plants get? Because I think people think small fruit, small plant.
No, cherry tomato plant, the vine can take over side of a high tunnel.
Yeah.
And most of our farmers know what a high tunnel is.
Mm-hmm.
It can, long as it has the nutrients in the soil. And you all won't believe, I grow cherry tomatoes in a bucket. Like, I have done that, and it takes over the wall, like the bucket, you know, and I'm doing buckets, and I just let it run up that thing. And then if they get too heavy, because they get heavy, people don't understand, they fall over because it has so many tomatoes on them. Yeah. And then I'll tie them to the rafter of the high tunnel to make them go up. That's why I love cherry tomatoes.
Yeah, the first year I grew them, I was like, oh my God.
They take
these
over
things are
like
huge. Yeah, I call them the gorilla of the garden, boy.
Yeah, they take over.
Yeah, you mentioned your buckets a couple of minutes. We've got a few minutes left. Can you explain to people exactly what your bucket method entails?
Yes, sir. So I learned this from one of my clients. The gentleman was former military. And so his notion was get up and go, you know, like the quick bag, the go bag type of, you know, that's the military mentality is be able to pack up really quickly. And so he wanted to do his garden like that because he was on leased land. It was not his land, so he wanted to be able to pick up and leave whenever he needed to. So he started out with buckets. He bore one hole in the center of the bucket. He was getting his buckets from a gentleman like bakeries and places that use food in them have like the icing. The icing comes in 5-gallon buckets, but then the bakery don't know what to do with the buckets. And so you could go and sometimes get free buckets for a dollar, you know, like some for some form of fashion. But we're not talking about just walking in Lowe's and Home Depot buying buckets. They are expensive.
$4 a piece.
Yeah, they're very expensive. So we're talking about working with your community to get buckets, one hole in the bottle, the large, and we use the drill bit that, you know, to make a hole, but it's just that center of the bucket, making one hole. And what I do for aeration, so I started out with field dirt, but then when I went and got it, it was at a local nursery. It was better than field dirt. And I was like, why? Because literally people have to understand field dirt is supposed to not have anything in it. Mm-hmm. Like it's no nutrients whatsoever. Mm-hmm. It's truly dirt. Soil have nutrients. And so I went to get that just to fill the bottom of the bucket up. I ended up getting spectacular organic matter. It was good topsoil, but they were selling it as field dirt. So meaning I got it cheap, but it was a good topsoil. And so I got a trailer full of that, and we brought it and filled up all our buckets. Then from there, I use hay. Being a livestock producer, I have hay here. I put hay in there, and that was strictly for aeration, to make sure there's an air pocket in there. And then on top of that, I put black cow. I'm a fan of black cow, and I know it's expensive, but I like black cow. And then when I don't use, and I only use black cow when I'm out of compost, because you can run out of compost.
Yeah, and black cow ain't cheap, you know?
Yeah, it's not cheap at all.
I was a black hen man, but nobody sells it around here anymore. I'm gonna have to move to black cow.
It's good, but keep in mind though, if you compost, put compost over that. I like I said, that's composted cow manure. So if you don't, you know, I'm not telling people to go out and buy, because it's, you know, with taxes right at close $6 a bag. And so you're here in Mississippi, could be higher other places, but that you could put compost in the place of that black cow. You're using everything from the land. If you're a livestock producer, you got hay, you got your compost there. And a lot of people, like one of my elders, filled the soil to fill the bucket. She would have went out in the woods. She would have filled it up still naturally from the land. So you could do that as well. Okay. Just go in
and how many buckets do you typically plant a year?
Oh, my goodness. We are, because that particular client that I helped, I was helping him, and then he taught me how to do that. He had over 200 somewhere. And when they moved from Mississippi, I bought there. But so we're probably about 300-400 buckets now.
Wow.
And I'm getting ready to do a new haul. I'm getting ready to buy more this year. Because the other thing is their buckets, the heat. By being in Georgia, Mississippi, the 100 degree, the buckets start to degrade over the years. And so when you pick them up and try to move them, they just disintegrate.
Hey, we have that problem when it gets really cold. It just, once it warms back up, it's just brittle. Oh my goodness. I just, you were just saying something. I just lost my train of thought. So I'll ask you this question. So a lot of people in urban areas are getting interested in agriculture, and it's like this little simmering controversy right now. And I respect people on both sides of the argument, but there's now some farmers who sort of have some resentment about some of the advances that urban agriculture is making. And, you know, a lot of people who farm in urban areas are market gardeners. If they're not farming, you know, for their own benefit. So, and, you know, a couple of people that I talked to, one, they have a problem with how much money is being directed toward urban ag. And these are folks, if I were to mention their name, you'd know them right off the bat. So, you know, some of them are elders and they're like, you know, that's not really farming to me. And then, you know, why are they giving all these people farm and track numbers when they're just growing in their backyard and it's 50 feet, you know, it's five rows of land. And I can understand that a little bit. But I can also understand there's some urban operations like mine that's really a true farm. So I know you work with some urban farms in your area. You're there with Miss Cindy and folks like that. You know, where do you come down on this whole thing? So
no, I want everybody to grow. So I don't get into this urban rural. To be honest with you, I'll probably be hated, but I liked when NRCS opened up their financial resources for urban farmers. Because my thing is, people forgetting, we're in a pandemic.
Yeah.
Everybody needs to be growing some food. I'm sorry. I don't get hung up on who's doing it and where they're doing it at. Everybody needs to be growing food in their backyard, on their rooftop, whatever space they have, on their balcony, on an apartment, in an apartment. I want people to grow food. So I don't get hung up on that. I'm glad it's enough resources out here for all farmers, backyard gardeners, urban farms, urban gardeners. I just don't believe in that.
Okay. So going back to Jill Newfarmer, what are the three biggest mistakes that you see a new farmer or beginning farmer make when they're setting up a market garden, you know, setting up something where they're going to be trying to sell produce to other people?
First one is not planning. That's the biggest mistake, not planning. The other is taking on too much at one time. So meaning they're trying to grow too much and they knew you got a learning curve. You got to learn. So hone in on one or two crops, master those, and then add.
Right.
So one is just too much diversity. And then three is not finding a market. So they don't have that market first. They grow all of this food and then go try to find a market. Yeah. That's a no-no. Yeah.
And I always, you know, one of the lessons that we learned when we first started out is what you like to eat may not be something that other people may necessarily. And
exactly.
we were pretty good at growing like Asian vegetables. So one year we grew all this bok choy and we took it to market. We practically couldn't give it away. Now, this is before local food was really a thing. So you had your traditional Southern person coming through a market, black or white. And what do they want? They want red tomatoes. They want their butter beans. They want their field peas, that type of stuff. We couldn't give away. So a lot of we ate as much as we can, but a lot of that went to the compost. So, you know, that was a big mistake that we learned. One thing that we haven't talked about in the few minutes that we have left is water.
Yes.
And how you irrigate your crops and your particular property, and how do you think market gardeners should approach that when they're setting up their garden?
Yeah, so we do still, we're manual labor here, and so we still water with water hoses, and then water hoses tied to sprinkler and stuff like that. But people have to realize I'm not large acreage when it comes to vegetable production. I have acreage for animals. So I always have to give that disclaimer. So the acreage is not for vegetables and stuff. And so I'm able to do hand watering and so forth, because again, it's intensive. And other ways that I would love for farmers to look into is rainwater catchment. So that's even for our urban people, but of course, rural as well. And then especially the rural farmers look into and save for a well. You may not be able to get it through NRCS at this time. Rules have changed and so forth, but I would save up for it and have your own your well dug. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, we're pretty much all on drip now. And, you know, in the new high tunnel, the newest one we got, NRCS, I guess they're recommending this for most of the high tunnels that they finance now, that they cost share on, is that they automatically course sharing drip for it. So so we had to go with what they said. So we're using the actual drip tape, but and we've had that before. The problem for us has been birds or chipmunks, especially during the summer, would go down and bite it to get something to drink. Or even if you're just working around the plants, it was very easy to damage it. So we started using that micro irrigation, you know, the quarter inch tubes with the emitters. And I like that stuff because you can roll it up at the end of the year and just hang it up at the end of the bed and just roll it back out. It's pretty durable.
We
got approved for a rainwater catchment system. I got to get my butt done and do this shed, because originally we had a permaculturist come in. She designed a system, a 12,000 gallon system that will run off the house, at least the house that was here before it burnt down. But NRCS said it couldn't be attached to your permanent residence. And so we didn't even think about it, but we got a new NRCS guy. He said, oh, just attach it to your shed or to your hoop house.
Gotcha.
And so we're just going to have Brandy tie her system into it. So
a lot of water come off of that.
Yeah, just off of that roof. You know, it was 120,000 gallons in an average. I was just amazed at how much water we get.
It's
now, we made the house smaller. We want to, you can't talk sustainability and have a house that wastes heat and energy. And
stuff. Yeah. Now, one thing, Mr. Brandon, that we forgot to mention about Market Garden is permanent beds. We had talked about that because, you know, like most of us are always, you know, every season we're making our beds. We're going in there and redoing and redoing. This is not, Market Garden is permanent beds. And so with people that use Landscape fabric, they're able to, you know, you're not going in and tilling every season.
Right.
No, no, no. That bed is permanent and you pull, even if you're using Landscape fabric, you're pulling your harvest out. And then, you know, if you want to roll back your Landscape fabric and add amendments and stuff, but that bed is still shaped. You know, and sometimes like some of our farmers, they'll go reshape the bed and so forth, but they don't do that hard tilling, disking. That's a no-no. So
I'm glad you brought that up too.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm glad you brought that up too. Cause you know, we use permanent wood. We just spent the money and brought the plain pine boards for our beds, but we have shaped them outside. We do have some beds that we just shaped outside, just mounded them up. And you had mentioned compaction. I can't tell you how many times I've seen people have these beautiful beds and they go step in them, you know?
Yes. Not
they
knowing.
They step in the beds. And I remember giving a demonstration at a school garden and the people giving a demonstration was stepping in the bed, you know?
I'm like, oh my goodness. They don't understand. That's that's hard work to create those beds and stuff. And then I'd understand. But again, that's soil education there.
They're not
understanding that what you're doing is compacting the soil.
Yeah. And then once you start running that tiller, so all we'll do is just hand cultivate a little bit, just to loosen the soil up. But you'd be surprised once your beds get established how much soil life is in there. You know, your earthworms, all of that stuff is in there. And, it just is really a system unto itself, you know.
And
the less you can... You can destroy that system, the better off you are. You know?
And I think it's really for people that just want to grow but don't have a lot of time. It's for people that are getting up in age and may not do the type of farming they used to do, just that hard manual labor, but they still able to get around, bend over, bend down and stuff. But this just makes it easier.
Yeah.
It's more efficient.
Yeah.
And that's the purpose why we moved to it, because I've been doing this manual labor, hard work for 10 plus years. I'm tired.
Yeah, and you and I both work with farmers. And what's the first thing somebody wants to start? Well, I need to get a tractor. Well, why you need a tractor?
I don't even own a tractor. I've never owned a tractor and stuff. I say I want this BCS, but to be honest with you, I'll never buy one because we don't need it.
No, neither do we. And you know what? If it ever came down, you know, we still have one piece of the property that we haven't planted in, and we're thinking about what we want to do with it because there's a lot of hardwoods on. And Miss Gwen is like, no, you can get rid of these pine trees, but don't touch the hardwoods.
Exactly.
But before I would go out and buy something, I'd hire somebody to come in and do the work.
I'm glad you brought that up because most people don't do that. I utilize that too, Mr. Brandon, for as renting equipment. A lot of our farmers don't really think about that and they want to buy the equipment, but they're not realizing how much money they're spending in maintenance while the equipment is sitting.
Yeah.
You got to winterize it, all of the things that you're spending money on. When I rent it for, you know, 2-3 days, a week or whatever, and then I give it back to the owner, you know, give it back to that company, and they winterize it for me to get it back in the spring. So I just have done that. And even my old son, at first, he was like, Mom, we buy. And then when he saw how it was so easy, but we had a trailer, we had the equipment to go pick up. Equipment and stuff. So that was easier, but I know some people don't have all of that, but you can rent trailers. You can rent trailers. Yeah. You can rent the equipment and stuff. Cause like one of the big things we utilize now is an auger. And I was like,
I was just about to say that. That's the last thing I rented.
Yeah. I was like, but I'm thinking about buying one. Man, we're using it quite a bit here now. And I'm like, we're using it.
I brought one in the pull string. I got it off of Amazon. So I think it just may have been maybe it's a cheap Chinese model. We can go get it fixed. But before we brought one, we rented it for Home Depot. And I think it was $100 for like 24 hours or something like that.
Yeah.
And then if you time it right, if you rent it like mid morning, then you've got some daylight time the next day to use it. But man, that was I'm like, here it goes. Yep.
I know.
Yep. It's here you go.
I love augers. It's especially fruit trees, nut trees and stuff like that. It's just it's easy to do. And then posts, if you gotta put down fencing, you can that post hole digger. And I did that for many years.
That's
played out now. We're not doing no post hole dig.
I had a fence put in recently because we finally had the house next to us was vacant for the old people who there died and was vacant for a long time. And then finally somebody in the family brought it. And it just felt funny after years of not having anybody over there. Now somebody was over there and we getting ready to put our swimming pool back. So we put in the fence. At first, I was crazy enough to think I could put it in. Me and my son could put it in myself. My wife said, no, we're going to pay somebody to do this.
I know.
These guys actually use a post hole digger and mix of cement. There was no way in heck me and my son was going to be able to do that. It would have taken a whole year for us to do that.
I know. Yeah, to put down a fence because it's hard work. And then I don't know what soil type you have, Mr. Brad, but see, we're clay. That's like concrete here. You cannot do it without a machine.
Yeah. We've got a lot of rock. So it's soft rock.
Well, it's the same thing.
Yeah.
It's just hard, to do it. You got to have a machine. Yes, sir.
Yeah.
So, tools are needed, but we got to learn how to, purchase the right tools that we're going to use all the time. Mm-hmm. But then, if farmers can learn rent, and it's so much cheaper. At the end of the year, you'll look back and be grateful because you didn't spend all that money.
Yeah.
You really didn't spend all that money.
And the other thing as we get toward closing is really buying quality tools. So before I used to go to Home Depot and buy, the hand cultivators, and they fall apart over the course of the season. Mm-hmm. And so now we get stuff like from Haas Tools. We spend the money. It may be three times the price of what's Home Depot, but you know what? We still have them. They'll last us years.
Yep.
They'll last us years. And one of the things I'm looking for, maybe you might know, we go through a lot of hose heads every year, even though we have the drip, from dropping them on the ground. So I'm really looking for some quality hose heads now where we'll get a couple of seasons out of them. So.
But then what you're speaking of, though, you are a market gardener.
Mm-hmm.
You got to be making money to justify paying a lot for tools. If you're not there yet, farmers, you can't do that. Like,
That's a good point.
You start out cheap to get to a point that your farm can buy this expensive equipment. Yeah. It is expensive, but in the long run, it's you keep it for years. Some of the stuff outlasts you, to be honest with you. Some of this equipment outlasts you. So it is those type of equipment. Because, I got equipment from my grandfather. But, it's some tools that really, really last. And yes, you have to make an investment.
All right, Miss Felicia, we're coming to the end of the show. In closing, I'm going to give you a few minutes just to give some words of wisdom, although you're giving us a lot on this on the show, but just give some closing thoughts on for especially new and beginning folks want to get into this space.
I appreciate it so much, Mr. Brandon. Closing thoughts is to most farmers is try it. New and beginning farmers, try market garden regardless of your size, and then ask questions. It's so much research online for you to learn about market garden books, as well as YouTube channels. And then also you may have someone in your local area that they are a market gardener. And so I just ask farmers, try it, because you will get more bang for the buck, because you can diversify. So that means you're going to make more money. You're not monoculture. And so you'll make more money either at the farmer's market or even at your farm stand. So at least try it, but get the help that you need.
Right. And I'm glad you mentioned about monoculture. I had a show with, I don't know if you know Scott Marlowe. You probably bumped into Scott.
Yeah.
But one of the things he says about small, highly diversified farmers, you spread your risk out across the seasons.
You know,
by the time summer comes, we've probably banked a third of our income, because we've gotten it in. So if there's a drought this summer, we'll just deal with it with our summer crops. It's not like the whole season was a loss to us. So, Miss Felicia, in your role with NCAP, what states do you service?
Yeah, so we're Mississippi, Louisiana, Alabama, Georgia, and Florida.
Okay, and if I point people to the NCAP
website, they can get in touch with the office there in Jackson if they have questions? Or
yes, sir. So if they go to, it is ATRA, A-T-T-R-A, dot N as Nancy, C-A-T, dot org. You go to that website and we have at the top a drop down, and that's where you'll see all of the offices, and we're the Gulf States regional office. And then that'll come to our homepage, and you'll be able to see our phone number, where we're located. And of course, because we're in the pandemic, we are working remotely, but you definitely can still call our phone numbers. Just give us a little time to answer. That's what I've seen over 2020. People will hang up because it's transferring to our personal phones. And so people will hang up before we actually can answer. So please, please let the phone ring because it's transferring to our personal phone.
Okay. And they can also email as well.
Definitely. Right? Yes, sir. Definitely.
Okay.
And most of us.
Now, I know you. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say it is our name. So it's our first name and our last name initial. So for myself, it's Felicia B. at NCAT.org. So all of our specialists is their first name and then their last name initial at NCAT.org.
Okay. And once again, I want to thank you for being in the show. I know you're super busy, a super busy lady, between you, your farm, your son, all your son's businesses. And but you do speak at conferences. So anybody who's putting on any type of event and want this type of knowledge, is please reach out to Miss Felicia. I've seen her speak on quite a few panels and actually had her do some training for me. And she also does some individual consulting. Now, you got to pay for that, y'all. But if you really, if you have the wherewithal and you're really looking for somebody to come in and work with you on your farms, you know, that's another myth about our people that folks have about our people is that we don't want to pay for professional advice. I don't think that's true. I see Black people all the time, as long as they're getting value for that.
Exactly.
So you can contact Miss Felicia if you have any specific needs, whether it be around pasture management for your livestock or soil health or helping you to establish market garden. I'm sure she'll reach out to you. So I want to thank you once again, Felicia, for taking the time for us. And this has been the Sustainable Ag Writer. And we'll see you guys next week.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Sustainable Ag Writer podcast. Please visit our website at sustainableagwriter.com, where you can subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. If you found value in this show, we'd appreciate a rating on iTunes. Please tell your friends and colleagues about the show and follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Once again, thank you for listening to the Sustainable Ag Writer podcast, sustainable ag news and views.